Chapter 17. Shygek. In terror, all men throw up their hands and turn aside their faces. Remember, Trata, always preserve the face, for that is where you are. Thrasianus, Triamus Imperator. The poet will yield up his stylus only when the geometer can explain how life can at once be a point and a line. How can all time, all creation, come to the now? Make no mistake, this moment, the instant of this very breath, is the frail thread from which all creation hangs. That men dare to be thoughtless. Teres and Sancius, the City of Men. Early Autumn, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Shygek. One day, returning from the river with their laundered clothes, Esmonette overheard several men of the Tusk discussing the Holy War's preparations for their continuing march. Kellis spent part of the afternoon with her and Serwe explaining how the Kianine, before retreating across the desert, had slaughtered every camel on the south bank, just as they'd burned every boat before retreating across the Sempis. Since then, forays into the deserts of Kamema to the south had found every well poisoned. The Padiraja, Kellis said, hopes to make of the desert what Scotus hoped to make of the Sempis. The great names, of course, were undeterred. They planned to march along the coastal hills followed by the imperial fleet, which would provide them with all the water they would need. The road would be laborious. They would have to send parties of thousands through the hills to collect the water. But it would see them safely to Anathpania, to the very marches of the sacred land, long before the Padiraja could possibly recover from his defeat at Anwarat. Soon you two will be shuffling through sand, Kellis said in the warm, teasing manner that Esmonette had learned to love long ago. It'll be hard for you, Serwe, heavy with child, carrying our pavilion on your back. The girl shot him a look, at once scolding and delighted. Esmonette laughed, at the same time realizing she'd be traveling even farther from Akamian. She wanted to ask Kellis if he'd heard any word from Zynemus, but she was too frightened. Besides, she knew Kellis would tell her as soon as any news arrived, and she knew what that news would be. She'd glimpsed it in Kellis's eyes many, many times. Once again they'd gathered about the same side of the fire to avoid the winding smoke, Kellis in the center, Serwe on his right, and Esmonette on his left. They were cooking small pieces of lamb on sticks, which they ate with small pieces of bread and cheese. This had become a favorite treat of theirs, one of many little things that had kept the promise of family. Kellis leaned past her to grab more bread, still teasing Serwe. Have you ever pitched a pavilion across sand before? Kellis, Serwe complained and exulted. Esmonette breathed deeply his dry, salty smell. She couldn't help herself. They say it takes forever, he chided, withdrawing his hand and accidentally brushing Esmonette's right breast. The tingle of inadvertent intimacy, the flush of a body suddenly thick with a wisdom that transcended intellect. For the remainder of the afternoon, Esmonette found her eyes plagued by a nagging waywardness. Where before, her look had confined itself to Kellis's face, it now roamed over his entire form. It was as though her eyes had become brokers, intermediaries between his body and her own. When she saw his chest, her breasts tingled with the prospect of being crushed. When she glimpsed his narrow hips and deep buttocks, her inner thighs hummed with expectant warmth. Sometimes her palms literally itched. Of course, this was madness. Esmonette needed only to catch Serwe's watchful eyes to recall herself. Later that night, after Kellis had left, the two of them stretched across their mats, their heads almost touching, their bodies angled to either side of the fire. They often did this when Kellis was away. They stared endlessly into the flames, sometimes talking, but mostly saying nothing at all, save yelping when the fire spat coals.
Esme?
Serwe asked in a peculiar, brooding tone.
Yes, Sercha?
I would, you know.
Esmonette's heart fluttered.
You would what?
Share him,
the girl said. Esmonette swallowed.
No, never, Serwe. I told you not to worry.
But that's what I'm saying. I don't fear losing him, not anymore, and not to anyone. All I want is what he wants. He's everything.
Esmanette lay breathless, staring between legs of wood at the pulsing furnace of coals.
Are you saying that he
wants me? Serway laughed softly.
Of course not, she said.
Of course not, Esmanette repeated. With an inner shrug, she shook away these mad and maddening thoughts. What was she doing? He was callous, callous. She thought of Akka, blinked two burning tears.
Never, Serway.
Kellis didn't return until the following night, when he rode into their little camp accompanied by Proyas himself. The Kunryan prince looked particularly travel-worn and haggard. He was dressed in a simple blue tunic, his riding clothes, Esmanette supposed. Only the gold-embroidered intricacy of his hems spoke to his station. His beard, which he usually kept clipped close to his jaw, had grown out, so that it more resembled the square-cut beards of his caste nobles. At first, Esmanette kept her gaze averted, worried Proyas might guess the intensity of her hatred if he glimpsed her eyes. How couldn't she hate him? He'd not only refused to help Akamian, he'd refused to allow Zynemus to help as well, and had divested the marshal of his rank and station when he insisted. But something in his voice, a high-born desperation, perhaps, made her watchful. He seemed uncomfortable, even forlorn, as he took his place beside Kellis at the fire, so much so that she found her dislike faltering. He, too, had loved Akamian once. Zynemus had told her as much. Perhaps that's why he suffered. Perhaps he wasn't so unlike her. That, she knew, was what Kellis would say. After pouring everyone watered wine and serving the men the remnants of the meal she'd prepared for herself in Serway, Esmanette took a seat on the far side of the fire. The men discussed matters of war as they ate, and Esmanette was struck by the contradiction between the way Proyas deferred to Kellis and the general reserve of his manner. Suddenly, she understood why Kellis forbade his followers from joining their camp. Men like Proyas, like any of the great names, she supposed, would be troubled by Kellis. Those at the center of things are always more inflexible, always more invested than those at the edges, and Kellis promised a new center. It was easy to move from edge to edge. The men fell silent to finish their lamb, onions, and bread. Proyas set aside his plate, washed his palate with a sip of wine. He glanced at Esmanette, inadvertently it seemed, then stared off into the distance. Esmanette suddenly found the quiet suffocating.
How fares the Skilvendi? She asked, uncertain of what else to say.
He glanced back to her. For an instant, his eyes lingered on her tattooed hand.
I see him but rarely,
the handsome man replied, staring into the flames.
But I thought he counseled.
She paused, suddenly uncertain as to the propriety of her words. Akamian had always complained of her forward manner with caste nobles.
Counseled me on war?
Proyas shook his head, and for a brief instant she could see why Akamian had loved him. It was so strange being with those he'd once known. Somehow it made his absence at once palpable and easier to bear. He was real. He had left his mark. The world remembered.
After Kellis explained what happened at Anwarat, the prince continued, the council hailed Naor as the author of our victory. The priests of Gilgeol even declared him battle celebrant, but he would have nothing of it.
The prince took another deep draught of wine.
He finds it unbearable, I think. As a Skilvendi among Enrithi?
Proyas shook his head, set his empty bowl curiously close to his right foot.
Liking us, he said.
Without further word, he stood and excused himself. He bowed to Kellis, thanked Serway for the wine in her gracious company, then, without so much as glancing at Esmanette, strode off into the darkness. Serway stared at her feet. Kellis seemed lost in otherworldly ruminations. Esmanette sat silently for a time, her face burning, her limbs and thoughts itching with a peculiar hum. It was always peculiar, even though she knew it as well as the taste of her own mouth. Shame. Everywhere she went, it was her characteristic stink.
I'm sorry, she said to the two of them.
What was she doing here?
What could she offer other than humiliation? She was polluted, polluted. And here she stayed with Kellis? With Kellis? What kind of fool was she? She couldn't change who she was no sooner than she could wash the tattoo from the back of her hand. The seed she could rinse away, but not the sin. Not the sin. And he was... I'm sorry, she sobbed. I'm sorry. Esmonette fled the fire, crawled into the solitary darkness of her tent, of his tent, Akka's. Kellis came to her not long after, and she cursed herself for hoping he would. I wish I were dead, she whispered, lying face first against the ground. So do many. Always implacable honesty. Could she follow where he led? Had she the strength? I've only loved two people in my life, Kellis. The prince never looked away, and they're both dead. She nodded, blinked tears. You don't know my sins, Kellis. You don't know the darknesses I harbor in my heart. Then tell me. They talked long into the night, and a strange dispassion moved her, rendering the extremities of her life, death, loss, humiliation, curiously inert. Whore. How many men had embraced her? How many gritty chins against her cheek? Always something to be endured, all of them punishing her for their need. Monotony had made them seem laughable, a long queue of the weak, the hopeful, the ashamed, the angered, the dangerous. How easily one grunting body replaced the next, until they became abstract things, moments of a ludicrous ceremony, spilling bowel-hot libations upon her, smearing her with their meaningless paint, one no different from the next. They punished her for that as well. How old had she been when her father had sold her to the first of his friends? 11, 12? When had the punishment begun? When had he first lain with her? She could remember her mother weeping in the corner, but not much more. And her daughter, how old had she been? She had thought her father's thoughts, she explained. Another mouth, let it feed itself. The monotony had numbed her to the horror, had made degradation a laughable thing. To trade flashing silver for milky seed? The fools. Let my Mara be schooled in the foolishness of men, clumsy, rutting animals. One need only pay with a little patience, mimic their passion, wait, and soon it would be over. In the morning, one could buy food. Food from fools, my Mara. Can't you see, child? Shush. Stop weeping. Look. Food from fools. That was her name? Kellis asked. My Mara? Yes, Esmonette said. Why could she say that name now when she could never utter it with a Commian? Strange the way long sorrow could silence the pang of unspeakable things. The first sobs surprised her. Without thinking, she leaned into Kellis and his arms enclosed her. She wailed and beat softly against his chest, heaved and cried. He smelled of wool and sunburned skin. They were dead, the only ones she'd ever loved. After her breathing settled, Kellis pressed her back and her hands fell slack to his lap. Over the course of several heartbeats, she felt him harden against the back of her wrist, as though a serpent flexed beneath wool. She neither breathed nor moved. The air, as silent as a candle, roared. She pulled her hands away. Why? Why would she poison a night such as this? Kellis shook his head, softly laughed. Intimacy begets intimacy, Esme. So long as we remember ourselves, there's no reason for shame. All of us are frail. She looked down to her palms, her wrists, smiled. I remember. Thank you, Kellis. He raised his hand to her cheek, then ducked from her little tent. She rolled to her side, squeezed her hands, palm to palm, between her knees, and murmured curses until she fell asleep. The message had arrived by sea, the man said. He was Galioth, and from the look of his surcoat, a member of Sauban's own household. Proyas weighed the ivory scroll case in his hand. It was small, cold to the touch, and finely worked with tiny tusks. Clever workmanship, Proyas thought. Innumerable tiny representations, each figure defined by further figures, so that there was no blank ground to throw each into relief, only tusks and more tusks. There was a sermon, Proyas mused, even in the container of this message. But then that was Mathanet. Sermons all the way down. The Khanraian prince thanked and dismissed the man, then returned to his chair by his field table. It was hot and humid in his pavilion, so much so he found himself resenting the lamps for their added heat. He'd stripped down to a thin white linen tunic and had already decided that he would sleep naked after he investigated this letter. With his knife, he carefully broke the canister's wax seal. He tipped it, and the small scroll slid out, fastened by yet another seal, this one bearing the Shriya's own mark. What could he want? Proyas brooded for a moment on the privilege of receiving such letters from such a man. Then he snapped the wax seal, peeled open the parchment roll.
Lord Prince Nerse Proyas, may the gods of the gods shelter you and keep you. Your last missive.
Proyas paused, struck by a sense of guilt and mortification. Months ago, he'd written Mathanet at a Kamian's behest, asking about the death of a former student of his, Paro Inrao. At the time, he hadn't believed he would actually send it. He'd been certain that writing the letter would make sending it impossible. What better way to at once discharge and dispose of an obligation? Dear Mathanet, a sorcerer friend of mine wants me to ask whether you killed one of his spies. It was madness. There was no way he could send such a letter. And yet, how could he not feel a sense of kinship to this Inrao, this other student a Kamian had loved? How could he not remember everything about the blasphemous fool, the wry smile, the twinkling eyes, the lazy afternoons doing drills in the gardens? How could he not pity him? A good man, a kind man, hunting fables and wives' tales to his everlasting damnation. Proyas had sent the letter, thinking that at long last the matter of his mandate tutor could be put to rest. He'd never expected a reply, not truly. But he was a prince, an heir apparent, and Mathanet was the Shriya of the Thousand Temples. Letters between such men somehow found their way, no matter how fierce the world between them. Proyas continued reading, holding his breath to numb the shame. Shame at having sent such a trivial matter to the man who had cleansed the three seas. Shame at having written this to a man at whose feet he'd wept. And shame for feeling shame at having fulfilled an old teacher's request.
Lord Prince Nerse Proyas, may the gods of the gods shelter you and keep you. Your last missive, we are afraid, left us deeply perplexed, until we recalled that you yourself once maintained several, how should we put it, dubious associations. We had been informed that the death of this young priest, Paro Inrao, had been a suicide. The College of Luthame, the priests charged with the investigation of this matter, reported that this Inrao had once been a student of mandate sorcery, and that he had recently been seen in the company of one Drusus Akamian, his old teacher. They believed that this Akamian had been sent to pressure Inrao into performing various services for his school, in short, to be a spy. They believe that as a result, the young priest found himself in an untenable position. Tribes 4-8. He wearies of breath, who has no place he might breathe. The responsibility for this young man's unfortunate death, we fear, lies with this blasphemer, Akamian. There is nothing more to it. May the god have mercy on his soul. Canticles 6:22. The earth weeps at words which know not the god's wrath. But as your missive left us perplexed, we fear that this missive shall leave you equally baffled. By allying the holy war with the Scarlet Spires, we have already asked much in the way of compromise from pious men. But in this it has been clear, we pray, that necessity forced our hand. Without the Scarlet Spires, the holy war could not hope to prevail against the Kishorum. Answer not blasphemy with blasphemy, our prophet says, and this verse has been oft repeated by our enemies.
But in answering the charges of the cultic priests, the prophet also says, many are those who are cleansed by way of iniquity, for the light must ever follow upon the dark, if it is to be light, and the holy must ever follow upon the wicked, if it is to be holy. So it is that the holy war must follow upon the scarlet spires, if it is to be holy. Scholars 1:3, let sun follow night, according to the arch of heaven. Now we must ask a further compromise of you, Lord Nurse Proyas. You must do everything in your power to assist this mandate schoolman. Perhaps this might not be as difficult as we fear, since this man was once your teacher in Aeocnesis. But we know the depth of your piety, and unlike the greater compromise we have forced upon you with the Scarlet Spires, there is no necessity that we can cite that might give comfort to a heart made restless by the company of sin. Hinteratus 28:4. I ask of you, is there any friend more difficult than the friend who sins? Assist Drusus Acamian, Proyas, though he is a blasphemer, for in this wickedness the holy shall also follow. Everything shall be made clear in the end, and it shall be glorious. Scholars 22:36. For the warring heart becomes weary and will turn to sweeter labors, and the peace of dawn's rising shall accompany men throughout the toils of the day. May the God in all his aspects shelter you and keep you. Mathenet. Proyas lowered the letter to his lap. Assist Drusus Acamian. What could the Shrier possibly mean? What could be at stake for him to make such a request? And what was he to do with such a request, now that it was too late, now that Acamian was gone? I killed him. And Proyas suddenly realized that he'd used his old teacher as a marker, as a measure of his own piety. What greater evidence could there be of righteousness than the willingness to sacrifice a loved one? Wasn't this the lesson of Angeshrael on Mount Kinsareya? And what better way to sacrifice a loved one than by hating or delivering him to his enemies? He thought of the whore at Kellis's fire, Acamian's lover, Esmanette. How desolate she'd seemed, how frightened. Had he authored that look? She's just a whore. And Acamian was just a sorcerer. Just. All men were not equal. Certainly the gods favored whom they would, but there was more. Actions determined the worth of any pulse. Life was the gods' question to men, and actions were their answers. And like all answers, they were either right or wrong, blessed or cursed. Acamian had condemned himself, had damned himself by his own actions, and so had the whore. This wasn't the judgment of Nerse Proyas. This was the judgment of the Tusk, of the latter prophet, Inri Sejanus. Then why this shame, this anguish? Why this relentless, heart-mauling doubt? Doubt. In a sense, that had been Acamian's single lesson. Geometry, logic, history, mathematics using Nilnameshi numbers, even philosophy, all these things were dross, Acamian would argue, in the face of doubt. Doubt had made them, and doubt would unmake them. Doubt, he would say, set men free. Doubt, not truth. Beliefs were the foundation of actions. Those who believed without doubting, he would say, acted without thinking, and those who acted without thinking were enslaved. That was what Acamian would say. Once, after listening to his beloved older brother, Tyramus, describe his harrowing pilgrimage to the sacred land, Proyas had told Acamian how he wished to become a Shrial knight. Why? The portly schoolman had exclaimed. They'd been strolling through the gardens. Proyas could remember bounding from leaf to fallen leaf just to hear them crackle beneath his sandals. They stopped near the immense iron oak that dominated the garden's heart. So I can kill heathens on the Empire's frontier. Acamian tossed his hands skyward in dismay. Foolish boy, how many faiths are there? How many competing beliefs? And you would murder another on the slender hope that yours is somehow the only one? Yes, I have faith. Faith, The schoolman repeated, as though recalling the name of a hated foe. Ask yourself, Prussia, what if the choice isn't between certainties, between this faith and that, but between faith and doubt, between renouncing the mystery and embracing it? But doubt is weakness, Proyas cried. Faith is strength, strength! Never, he was convinced, had he felt so holy as at that moment. The sunlight seemed to shine straight through him to bathe his heart.
Is it? Have you looked around you, Prussia? Pay attention, boy. Watch and tell me how many men out of weakness lapse into the practice of doubt. Listen to those around you and tell me what you see.
He did exactly as Akamian had asked. For several days he watched and listened. He saw much hesitation, but he wasn't so foolish as to confuse that with doubt. He heard the caste nobles squabble and the hereditary priests complain. He eavesdropped on the soldiers and the knights. He observed embassy after embassy posture before his father, making claim after florid claim. He listened to the slaves joke as they laundered or bicker as they ate. And in the midst of innumerable boasts, declarations, and accusations, only rarely did he hear those words Akamian had made so familiar, so commonplace, the words Proyas himself found so difficult. And even then, they belonged most to those Proyas considered wise, even-handed, compassionate, and least to those he thought stupid or malicious. I don't know. Why were these words so difficult?
Because men want to murder, Akamian had explained afterward. Because men want their gold and their glory. Because they want beliefs that answer to their fears, their hatreds, and their hungers.
Proyas could remember the heart-pounding wonder, the exhilaration of straying. Akka? He took a deep, daring breath. Are you saying the Tusk lies? A look of dread. I don't know. Difficult words. So difficult, they would see Akamian banished from Aeocnesis, and Proyas tutored by Karamamus, the famed trial scholar. And Akamian had known this would happen. Proyas could see that now. Why? Why would Akamian, who was already damned, sacrifice so much for so few words? He thought he was giving me something. Something important. Drusus Akamian had loved him. What was more, he'd loved him so deeply, he'd imperiled his position, his reputation, even his vocation, if what Zynemus had said was true. Akamian had given without hope of reward. He wanted me to be free. And Proyas had given him away, thinking only of rewards. The thought was too much to bear. I did it for the Holy War, for Shima. And now this letter, from Mathanet. He snatched up the parchment, scanned it once again, as though the Shrya's manly script might offer some answer. Assist Drusus Akamian. What had happened? The scarlet spires he could understand, but what use could the Shrya of the Thousand Temples have with a schoolman, and with a mandate schoolman, no less? A sudden chill dropped through him. Beneath the black walls of Momim, Akamian had once argued that the Holy War wasn't what it seemed. Was this letter proof of that fact? Something had frightened, or at least concerned, Mathanet, but what? Had he heard rumors of Prince Kellis? For weeks now, Proyas had meant to write the Shrya regarding the Prince of Atrathau, but for some reason he couldn't bring himself to put ink to parchment. Something compelled him to wait, but whether it was hope or fear he couldn't determine. Kellis simply struck him as one of those mysteries that could only be resolved through patience. And besides, what would he say? That the Holy War for the latter prophet was witnessing the birth of a latter prophet? As much as he was loath to admit it, Confis was right. The notion was simply too absurd. No. If the Holy Shrya harbored reservations concerning Prince Kellis, Proyas was fairly confident he would have simply asked. As it was, there wasn't so much as a hint, let alone mention, of the Prince of Atrathau in the letter. Chances were, Mathanet had no inkling of Kellis's existence, let alone his growing stature. No, Proyas decided. It must be something else. Something the Shrya thought beyond his tolerance or his ken. Otherwise, why not explain his reasons?
Could it be the consult?
The dreams, Achaemenian had said at Momum, they've been so forceful of late. Ah, back to the nightmares again. Something is happening, Proyas, I know it, I feel it. Never had he looked so desperate. Could it be?
No, it was too absurd. Even if they did exist, how could the Shrya find them when the Mandate themselves couldn't? No, it had to be the Scarlet Spires. After all, that had been Achaemenian's mission, hadn't it? Watch the Scarlet Spires?
Proyas yanked at his hair and snarled under his breath.
Why? Why couldn't this one thing be pure? Why must everything holy, everything, be riddled by tawdry and despicable intent?
He sat very still, drawing breath after shuddering breath. He imagined drawing his sword, slashing and hacking wildly through his chambers, howling and shrieking. Then he collected himself to the beat of his own pulse. Nothing pure. Love transformed into betrayal. Prayers bent into accusations. This was Mathanet's point, wasn't it? The holy followed upon the wicked.
Proyas had thought himself the moral leader of the holy war, but now he knew better. Now he knew he was merely one more piece upon the Benjuka plate. The players were perhaps known to him, the Thousand Temples, House Ikuri, the Scarlet Spires, the Kishorim, and perhaps even Kellis. But the rules, which were the most treacherous element of any game of Benjuka, were definitely not known.
I don't know. I don't know anything.
The Holy War had only triumphed, and yet never had he felt so desperate, so weak.
I told you, old tutor, I told you.
As though stirring from a stupor, Proyas called for Algeri, his old Saranj body slave, and bid the man to bring him his writing chest. As tired as he was, he had no choice but to answer the Shrya now. Tomorrow, the Holy War marched into the desert. For some reason, after unlatching the small mahogany and ivory chest and running his fingers over the quill and curled parchment, Nerse Proyas felt like a young boy once again, about to begin his writing drills under Achaemenian's hawkish but all-forgiving eyes. He could almost feel the sorcerer's friendly shadow looming watchfully over his boy's slender shoulders. That House Nerse could produce a boy so daft. That the School of Mandate could send a tutor so blind.
Proyas almost laughed his tutor's world-wise laugh, and tears clotted his eyes as he completed the first line of his baffled reply to Mathanet.
But it would seem, Your Eminence, that Drusus Achaemenian is dead. Esmenet smiled, and Kellis saw through her olive skin, through the play of muscles over bone, all the way to the abstract point that described her soul. She knows I see her, father. The campsite bustled with activity and rumbled with open-hearted conversation. The Holy War was about to march across the deserts of Kamema, and Kellis had invited all 14 of his senior Zaudunyani, which meant the Tribe of Truth in Kunayurik, to his fire. They already knew their mission. Kellis need only remind them of what he promised. Beliefs alone didn't control the actions of men. There was also desire, and these men, his apostles, must shine with that desire. The thanes of the warrior prophet. Esmenet sat across from him on the far side of the fire, laughing and chatting with her neighbors, Arweel and Persimus, her face flushed with a joy she wouldn't have dared imagine and couldn't yet dare admit. Kellis winked at her, then looked to the others, smiling, laughing, calling out, scrutinizing, dominating. Each was a riotous font of significance. The downcast eyes, quickened heart, and fumbling words of Atma spoke to the overpowering presence of Serwe, who blithely gossiped at his side. The momentary sneer the instant before Ulnarta smiled meant he still disapproved of Tishuma because he feared the blackness of his skin. The way Kassala, Gayamakri, and Hildarath oriented their shoulders toward Werjau, even while speaking to others, meant they still considered him to be first among them. And indeed, the way Werzhou tended to call across the fire more and more, leaning forward with his palms down while the others generally restricted their conversation to those beside them, spoke to the assertion of unconscious relations of dominance and submission. Werzhou even thrust out his chin.
"Tell me, Werzhou," Kellis called out. "What is it you see within your heart?"
Such interventions were inevitable. These were world-born men.
"Joy,"
Werzhou said, smiling, faint deadening about the eyes, flare in pulse, blush reflex. He sees, and he doesn't see. Kellis compressed his lips, rueful and forbearing.
"And what is it I see?"
This he knows. The sound of other voices trailed into silence. Werzhou lowered his eyes.
"Pride," the young Galioth said. "You see pride, master."
Kellis grinned, and the anxiety was swept from them. "Not," he said, "with that face, Werzhou." All of them, including Serway and Esmanet, howled with laughter, and Kellis glanced around the fire, satisfied. He could tolerate no posturing among them. It was the utter absence of presumption that made his company so utterly unique, that made their hearts leap and their stomachs giddy at the prospect of seeing him. The weight of sin was found in secrecy and condemnation. Strip these away, deny men their deceptions and their judgments, and their self-sense of shame and worthlessness simply vanished. They felt greater in his presence, both pure and chosen. Pragma Maigon stared through young Kellis's face, saw his fear.
"They're harmless," he said.
"What are they, Pragma?"
"Exemplary defectives, specimens. We retain them for purposes of education."
The Pragma simulated a smile.
"For students such as you, Kellis."
They stood deep beneath Ishual, in a hexagonal room within the mighty galleries of the thousand halls. Save for the entrance, staggered racks of knobbed and runneled candles covered the surrounding walls, shedding a light without shadows, and as bright and clear as the noonday suns. This alone made the room extraordinary. Light was otherwise forbidden in the labyrinth, but what made the room astonishing were the many men shackled in its sunken center. Each of them was naked, linen pale, and bound with greening copper straps to boards that leaned gently backward. The boards themselves had been arranged in a broad circle, with each man lying fixed within arm's reach of his comrades and positioned at the edge of the floor's central depression, so that a boy Kellis's height could stand at the lip of the surrounding floor and look the specimens directly in the face.
Had they possessed faces?
Their heads were drawn forward into open iron frames, where they were held motionless by bracketing bars. Behind their heads, wires had been fixed to the base of each frame. These swept forward in a radial fashion, ending in tiny silver hooks that anchored the obscuring skin. Slick muscle gleamed in the light. To Kellis, it looked as though each man had thrust his head into a spider web that had peeled away his face. Pragma Maigon had called it the Unmasking Room.
"To begin," the old man said, "you'll study and memorize each of their faces. Then you'll reproduce what you've seen on parchment."
He nodded to a battery of worn scrivening tables along the southern walls. His limbs as light as autumn leaves, Kellis stepped forward. He heard the masticating of pasty mouths, a chorus of voiceless grunts and gaspings.
"Their larynxes have been removed,"
Pragma Maigon explained,
"to assist concentration."
Kellis paused before the first specimen.
"The face possesses 44 muscles," the Pragma continued. "Operating in concert, they are capable of signifying every permutation of passion. All those permutations, young Kellis, derive from the 57 base and base removed types found here in this room."
Despite the absence of skin, Kellis immediately recognized horror in the flayed face of the specimen strapped before him. Like warring flatworms, the fine muscles about his eyes strained outward and inward at the same time. The larger, rat-sized muscles about his lower face yanked his mouth into a perpetual fear grin. Lidless eyes stared, rapid breaths hissed.
You're wondering how he can maintain that particular expressive configuration, the Pragma said. Centuries ago, we found we could limit the range of behaviors by probing the brain with needles, with what we now call neuropuncture. Keller stood transfixed. Without warning, an attendant loomed over him, holding a narrow reed between his teeth. He dipped the reed into the bowl of fluid he carried, then blowing, sprayed the specimen with a fine orangish mist. He then continued on to the next. Neuropuncture, the Pragma continued, made possible the rehabilitation of defectives for instructional purposes. The specimen before you, for instance, always displays fear at a base remove of 2.
Horror? Kellis asked.
Precisely.
Kellis felt the childishness of his own horror fade in understanding. He looked to either side, saw the specimens curving out of sight, rows of white eyes set in shining red musculatures. They were only defectives, nothing more. He returned his gaze to the man before him, to fear, base remove 2, and committed what he saw to memory. Then he moved on to the next gasping skein of muscles.
Good, Pragma Maigon had said from his periphery. Very good.
Kellis turned once more to Esmanette, peeled away her face with the hooks of his gaze. She'd already made 2 trips from the fire to her tent, promenades to draw his attention and covertly gauge his interest. She periodically looked from side to side, feigning amusement in things elsewhere to see if he watched her. Twice he let her catch him. Each time he grinned with boyish good nature. Each time she looked down, blushing, pupils dilated, eyes blinking rapidly, her body radiating the musk of nascent arousal. Though Esmanette had not yet come to his bed, part of her ached for him, even wooed him, and she knew it not. For all her native gifts, Esmanette remained a world-born woman, and for all world-born men and women, 2 souls shared the same body, face, and eyes, the animal and the intellect. Everyone was 2. Defective. One Esmanette had already renounced Drusus Akkamian. The other would soon follow. Esmanette blinked against the turquoise sky, held a hand against the sun. No matter how many times she witnessed it, she was dumbstruck. The Holy War. She'd paused with Kellis and Serwe on the summit of a rise so that Serwe could readjust her pack. Fields of Enrithi warriors and camp followers walked past them toward the crumbling cliffs of the southern escarpment. Esmanette looked from man to armored man, each farther than the next, past clots and through thickening screens, until losing them in the teeming distances where they winked in the sunlight like metal filings. She turned, saw the sand-colored walls of Amagnatis behind them, dwindling against the black and green of the river and her verdant banks. Shygek.
Goodbye, Akka.
Teary-eyed, she deliberately struck out on her own, simply waving a hand when Kellis called out to her. She walked among strangers, feeling the aim of hooded eyes and muttered words, as she so often did. Some men actually accosted her, but she ignored them. One even angrily grabbed her tattooed hand as though to remind her of something she owed all men. The parched grasses became thinner and thinner, leaving gravel that burned toes and cooked air. She sweat and suffered and somehow knew it was only the beginning. That evening, she found Kellis and Serwe without much difficulty. Though they had little fuel, they managed dinner with a small fire. The air cooled as quickly as the sun descended, and they enjoyed their first desert dusk. The ground radiated warmth like a stone drawn from a hearth. To the east, sterile hills ringed the distance, obscuring the sea. To the south and west, beyond the riot of the encampment, the horizon formed a perfect shale line that thickened into red as it approached the sun. To the north, Shygek could still be glimpsed between the tents, its green becoming black in the growing twilight. Serwe was already snoozing, curled across her mat close to the little lapping tongue of their fire. So how was your walk? Kellis asked.
I'm sorry, she said, shamefaced. There's no need to apologize, Esme. You walk where you choose.
She looked down, feeling both relieved and grief-stricken. So? Kellis repeated. How was your walk?
Men, she said leadenly. Too many men.
And you call yourself a harlot, Kellis said, grinning. Esmonette continued staring at her dusty feet. A shy smile stole across her face.
Things change.
Perhaps, he said in a manner that reminded Esmonette of an axe biting into wood. Have you ever wondered why the gods hold men higher than women? Esmonette shrugged.
We stand in the shadow of men, she replied, just as men stand in the shadow of the gods.
So you think you stand in the shadow of men? She smiled. There was no deception with Kellis, no matter how petty. That was his wonder.
Some men, yes.
But not many. She laughed, caught in an honest conceit.
Not many at all,
she admitted. Not even, she breathlessly realized, Akka.
Only you.
And what of other men? Aren't all men overshadowed in some respect?
Yes, I suppose.
Kellis turned his palms upward, a curiously disarming gesture.
So what makes you less than a man?
Esmonette laughed again, certain he played some game.
Because everywhere I've been, every place I've heard of for that matter, women serve men. That's simply the way. Most women are like...
She paused, troubled by the course of her thoughts. She glanced at Serwe, her perfect face illuminated by the wavering light of the fire.
Like her, Kellis said.
Yes, Esmonette replied, her eyes forced to the ground by a strange defensiveness.
Like her. Most women are simple.
And most men?
Well, certainly more men than women are learned, wise.
And is this because men are more than women? Esmonette stared at him, dumbfounded. Or is it, he continued, because men are granted more than women in this world? She stared, her thoughts spinning. She breathed deeply, set her palms carefully upon her knees.
You're saying women are actually equal?
Kellis hoisted his brows in pained amusement.
Why,
he asked, are men willing to exchange gold to lie with women?
Because they desire us. They lust.
And is it lawful for men to purchase pleasure from a woman?
No.
So why do they?
They can't help themselves,
Esmonette replied. She lifted a rueful eyebrow.
They're men.
So they have no control over their desire. She grinned in her old way.
Witness the well-fed harlot sitting before you.
Kellis laughed, but softly, and in a manner that effortlessly sorted her pain from her humor. So why, he said, do men herd cattle?
Cattle?
Esmonette scowled. Where had all these absurd thoughts come from?
Well, to slaughter for...
She trailed in sudden understanding. Her skin pimpled. Once again she sat in shadow, and Kellis hoarded the failing sun, looking for all the world like a bronze idol. The sun always seemed to relinquish him last.
Men, Kellis said, cannot dominate their hunger, so they dominate, domesticate the objects of their hunger, be it cattle or women,
she said breathlessly. The air prickled with understanding. When one race, Kellis continued, is tributary to another, as the Sepalorans are to the Nansur, whose tongue do both races speak?
The tongue of the conqueror.
And whose tongue do you speak? She swallowed.
The tongue of men.
With every blink, it seemed, she saw man after man arched over her like dogs.
You see yourself, Kellis said, as men see you. You fear growing old because men hunger for girls.
You dress shamelessly because men hunger for your skin. You cringe when you speak because men hunger for your silence. You pander, you posture, you primp and preen. You twist your thoughts and warp your heart. You break and remake, cut and cut and cut, all so you might answer in your conqueror's tongue.
Never, it seemed, had she been so motionless.
The air within her throat, even the blood within her heart, seemed absolutely still. Kellis had become a voice falling from somewhere between tears and firelight.
You say,
Let me shame myself for you. Let me suffer you. I beg you, please. And somehow, Esmonette knew where these words must lead, so she thought of other things, like how parched skin and cloth seemed so clean. Filth, she realized, needed water the same as men. And you tell yourself, Kellis continued, these tracks I will not follow. Perhaps you refuse certain perversities. Perhaps you refuse to kiss. You pretend to scruple, to discriminate, though the world has forced you onto trackless ground. The coins, coins for everything, and everything for coins, for the landlord, for the apparati when they come for their bribes, for the vendors who feed you, for the toughs with scabbed knuckles. And secretly, you ask yourself, what could be unthinkable when I'm already damned? What act lies beyond me when I have no dignity? What love lies beyond sacrifice? Her face was wet. When she drew her hand from her cheek, the whorls of her fingertips were black. You speak the tongue of your conquerors, Kellis whispered. You say, my Mara, come with me, child. A shiver passed through her as though she were a drumskin. And you take her.
She's dead,
some woman cried.
She's dead,
to the slavers in the harbor.
Stop,
the woman hissed.
I say, no,
gasping like knives. And you sell her. She remembered his arms enclosing her. She remembered following him to his pavilion. She remembered lying at his side, weeping and weeping, while his voice made her anguish plain, while Serwe stroked tears from her cheeks, ran cool fingers through her hair. She remembered telling them what had happened, about the hungry summer when she had swallowed men for free, just for their seed, about hating the little girl, the filthy little bitch who wept and demanded, who ate her food, who sent her into the streets, all because of love. About the hollow-eyed madness. Who could understand starvation? About the slavers, their larders growing fat because of the famine. About Maimara shrieking, her little girl shrieking. About the poison coins. Less than a week. They had lasted less than a week. She remembered shrieking, and she remembered weeping as she'd never wept before, because she'd spoken and he had heard. She remembered drifting in his confidence, in his poetry, in his godlike knowledge of what was right and true, in his absolution. You are forgiven, Esmonette.
Who are you to forgive?
My Mara. She awoke with her head upon his arm. There was no confusion, though it seemed there should be. She knew where she was, and though part of her quailed, part of her exulted as well. She lay with Kellis. I didn't couple with him. I only wept. Her face felt bruised from the previous evening. The night had been hot, and they'd slept without blankets. For what seemed a long time, she lay motionless, simply savoring his white-skinned nearness. She placed a hand upon his bare chest. He was warm and smooth. She could feel the slow drum of his heart. Her fingers tingled as though she touched an ironsmith's anvil as he hammered. She thought of the weight of him, flushed. Kellis, she said. She looked up to the profile of his face, somehow knowing he was awake. He turned and looked at her, his eyes smiling. She snorted in embarrassment, then looked away. Kellis said, it's strange, isn't it, lying so close?
Yes,
she replied, smiling, looking up, then out and away.
Very strange.
He rolled to face her. Esmonette heard Serwe groan and complain from his far side, still asleep.
Shh,
he said, laughing softly. She loves sleep more than me. Esmonette looked at him and laughed, shaking her head, beaming with incredulous excitement.
This is so strange,
she hissed. Never had her eyes felt so bright. She pressed her knees together in nervousness. He was so close. He leaned toward her, and her mouth slackened. Her eyes became heavy-lidded.
No,
she gasped. Kellis shot her a friendly frown. My loincloth just bunched, he said.
Oh,
she replied. They both burst into laughter. Again, she could sense the weight of him. He was a man who dwarfed her, as a man should. Then his hand was beneath her hasas, sliding between her thighs, and she found herself moaning into his sweet lips. And when he entered her, pinned her the way the nail of heaven pinned the skies, tears brimmed and spilled from her eyes, and she could only think, at last he takes me. And it did not seem. It was. No one would call her harlot anymore.